You're listening to DNA ID, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime, Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
On Monday, December 30th, 1985, a couple was walking along Mountain View Road in Auburn, Kings County, Washington, when they saw a white Lincoln Continental down a steep ravine. This was in the 2000 block of Mountain View Drive Southwest, across the street from the Mountain View Cemetery entrance. It appeared that the car had veered off the road and crashed down the wooded embankment. Two cemetery employees carefully climbed down the steep wooded hillside, digging into the dead leaves and undergrowth until they reached the vehicle. To their surprise, there was no one in the car, but a human skull lay on the ground within feet of the vehicle. It had not come from inside the car. The accident had just happened. The person in the vehicle hadn't had time to decompose to the point of skeletonizing. Instead, it quickly became apparent that the plunging vehicle had plowed into the earth on the hillside and had dislodged the skull, partially buried in the dirt and leaves. This was very, very bad news to the investigators in King County. They knew immediately that this skull was not a one-off. It lay on the ground about 250 yards from where another skull, that of young Kimmy Kai Pitsor, had been found 2 years earlier. It was immediately recognized that this was almost certainly the work of the Green River Killer. The Green River Killer was the moniker given by the media to the unknown serial killer who, at this time in December 1985, was believed responsible for the murders of 32 young women whose bodies had been found in the Green River region of King County since the summer of 1982, and the disappearances of 11 others. That number was about to go up. Search and rescue teams descended on the area wearing hard hats and protective gear and started pouring over the ravine looking for more bones. Green River Task Force investigators knew that the skull found near the Mountain View Cemetery was likely to lead to more bodies because the Green River Killer was known to put his victims in clusters of as many as 6 bodies. Kimmy Kai Pitsor's skull had been found 2 years earlier, but the rest of her had never been found. The finding of yet another skull was not a good sign because it clearly was not the rest of Kimmy Kai. And indeed, Auburn police and Green River Task Force officers searching the area found more bones the following day. They amounted to a substantial portion of a human body, according to Green River Task Force Lieutenant Jackson Beard. It was not a very pleasant New Year's for anyone involved in the Green River Task Force. The search for additional human remains continued throughout the week. King County Explorer Scouts search and rescue units joined in to cover the overgrown and wooded ground in the ravine, which had never been searched, despite Kimmy Kai being found 450 feet away 2 years earlier. The 200-foot-deep steep ravine had been written off as too difficult for the killer to have deposited bodies in, but that proved to be a great underestimation of this killer's commitment to his body depository sites. On Thursday, January 2, 1986, Explorer Scout Angie Osher found another skull, and soon additional bones were found amounting to nearly another whole skeleton. This was 40 to 50 feet uphill and to the east of where the first body was located, at the foot of a very large rotten stump on the peak of a ridge. The skulls were sent to the King County Medical Examiner's Office for comparison to the dental records of 11 missing women from the Green River area. The bones were also transported to the ME. Unfortunately, none of the dental records matched. The skull and bones found on Thursday were believed to belong to a white female, aged 14 to 17, according to Dr. Darris Swindler, a physical anthropologist at the University of Washington. The bones found on Monday and Tuesday belonged to a black female, aged 20 to 25. It was estimated that the bones found in the ravine had been in the area for 12 to 18 months. This was eventually raised to upwards of 24 months. The King County Medical Examiner said the women's deaths were due to, quote, homicidal violence of undetermined origin. They were added to the Green River Killer's toll, bringing his total number of known victims to 34. On Saturday, there was a third body. The new find was missing the skull and jawbone, but was definitely a distinct body from the bones found earlier in the week. These bones were found about 100 yards from where Kimi Kai's skull had been found, and indeed, it was immediately thought possible that they were the rest of Kimi Kai. In January, X-ray records of a broken arm suffered by Kimi Kai confirmed it. The remains were hers. But the other two bodies remained unidentified. All that was known was their approximate ages, race, and that they were female, that they'd been dead 2 to 3 years, and that they were victims of the Green River Killer, who had died from indeterminate homicidal violence. By January 1986, they were the only two of the 34 known victims who did not have names. This was not released to the public, but the remains were dubbed Bone 16 and Bone 17. They did not find all of Bone 17. Several bones were missing, but they had enough to know that she was a white female teenager, aged 14 to 19. She was around 5'4" to 5'8" and estimated at 130 pounds with undetermined hair color. Not one scrap of clothing, jewelry, or personal belongings was found with the body. This part's kind of crazy. Police learned that the Lincoln Continental Mark V had been stolen earlier that week on December 27th. Police issued a statement that they could not rule out that the car had been stolen by the killer, specifically for the purpose of ditching it down the ravine to attract the attention of the investigators to that area, a little hint of where they should be looking for more of his victims. Well, it worked, didn't it? It's kind of hard to believe that this wasn't already happening, but in January 1986, it was announced that the FBI was assigning 10 full-time agents to the Green River Task Force. Apparently, the fact that two of the now 34 victims had been transported across state lines, from Washington to Oregon, was the impetus for the FBI to commit some part-time agents to the task force the previous fall. But now, the FBI was making a full showing. The task force was already staffed with 42 King County police officers, 2 detectives from Seattle, and 2 Port of Seattle officers. The task force also hired 9 full-time data clerks to help in uploading all the information gathered by the investigation into a new $200,000 computer system designed to help the investigators cross-reference information. By November 1987, the Green River Killer's suspected death toll was up to 37 victims, and the task force had 12,000 names on its list of potential suspects. The killer had not struck in 4 years, and speculation was that he had left the area or been imprisoned for something else or died. Quote, "We may well have interviewed the Green River Killer and not yet been able to know verifiably that person is the Green River Killer," Lieutenant Dan Nolan of the Green River Task Force told the media. Time went by. Not only did the Green River Killer remain at large, with a suspected victim list that burgeoned to 49 women, but investigators were not able to identify bones 16 and 17 either. At the time, there was no way to link skeletonized remains to missing persons, other than by comparing missing persons' reports to specific bone structures in evidence. None of the missing women in the area fit the specifications of bones 16 and 17, although many comparisons were made and then ruled out. Meanwhile, the Green River Task Force actually came across the name Gary Ridgway a number of times and actually interviewed him more than once. In 1982, he was arrested for engaging in prostitution. In 1983, Ridgway was questioned after a tipster said that his truck resembled the one he saw Marie Malvar getting into before she vanished. Ridgway, who had perfected the art of being banal, denied having anything to do with Marie, and the police moved on. According to a prosecutor's summary of the Green River Killer case, quote, "During the 1980s, task force detectives investigated Ridgway and interviewed him on multiple occasions. He was generally cooperative. He admitted dating prostitutes, including at least one of the missing victims. He admitted assaulting a prostitute, Rebecca Guy, claiming he did so because she bit him. After one interview, Ridgway successfully passed a polygraph exam in which he denied killing any of the women. Ridgway passed the polygraph in 1984. In April 1987, the task force returned to Ridgway. They executed a search warrant for his home, work locker, and vehicles. None of the items they seized linked him to any of the crimes, some of which had DNA evidence, but task force investigators also collected a DNA sample in the form of saliva from Ridgway at that time, and they kept it. Ridgway kept killing until 1998. As he carried on slaying young women and girls, his youngest victim was 14, DNA testing technology advanced. In 2001, Detective Tom Jensen sent biological evidence from several Green River killer victims to the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab, the WSPCL for short, for DNA testing. Forensic scientists at the crime lab analyzed vaginal swabs from Marsha Chapman, pubic hairs from victim Opal Mills, and vaginal swabs from Carol Christensen, and compared them to a number of suspect samples, including Ridgway's. Male DNA on all three victims matched Ridgway's DNA. He was arrested on November 30, 2001. But after analyzing all the physical evidence from all 49 victims, the authorities were able to charge Ridgway in only 7 of the murders. Still, it was enough that they could dangle the threat of the death penalty over his head. Either the fear of being executed or a narcissist's desire to take credit for his actions led Ridgway to strike a deal with prosecutors. In exchange for them taking the death penalty off the table, quote, Ridgway agreed to provide complete, truthful, and candid information concerning his crimes in King County and answer all questions during interviews conducted by the police or the prosecuting attorney. Ridgway agreed to disclose the existence and precise location of all undiscovered physical remains of his victims. Ridgway agreed to plead guilty to aggravated murder in the first degree for all murders he committed in King County, end quote. The families of most of Ridgway's suspected victims backed the plea deal, preferring to have information and perhaps remains of their loved ones than to execute their killer. The information Ridgway provided went above and beyond the hopes of investigators. He was able to lead them to all the known dump sites and to dump sites they had never found. He was able to remember every detail of the murders and the victims he placed at each location. He admitted that he would return to the body dump sites again and again to have sex with the corpses, even the ones riddled with maggots. He was a true psychopath in every sense of the word, but he was also clever and cunning. As the Washington Post said, quote, Ridgway took a more disciplined, careerist approach to serial murder than any other American ever has. He sweated every detail of finding, killing, and disposing of human beings, end quote. Here are some of the steps Ridgway would take to ensure he wasn't caught. He stripped all his victims naked before leaving them outside and got rid of their clothing and personal items, knowing that if they had no identifying possessions, it would be harder to link them to him. He generally killed sex workers who he felt were less likely to attract police and public ire, but he made sure to patronize some sex workers and leave them alive so they would vouch for him for being a nice, gentle guy should the police inquire. Also, he would call some sex workers pimps after he had already killed them and ask for another date under the same fake John name so he looked innocent. He dumped the bodies in random places that were not connected to him and even placed 2 across the border in Oregon to throw police off the trail. This directly from the prosecutor's summary. Quote, he took precautions to leave no evidence at a scene. If one of his victims scratched him, he would cut her fingernails before disposing of the body. Once, when he feared that he might have left tire tracks near a dump site, Ridgway replaced the tires on his truck, end quote. One victim, Marie Malvar, scratched him so badly that he burnt his arms with battery acid to cover the marks, scarring himself permanently. And then this, which, as someone who spends a lot of time reading old case files and the investigative reports regarding evidence found at crime scenes, made my brain explode a tiny bit, quote, Ridgway placed evidence at the dump sites, which was deliberately intended to mislead police. Cigarette butts, chewing gum. He neither smoked nor chewed gum. At one scene, he scattered airport motel pamphlets and car rental papers to imply that the killer was a traveling salesman. He tossed a hair pick at one scene, hoping that if the body were discovered, investigators would suspect a pimp. He left one victim's driver's license at SeaTac Airport to suggest that she had left town, end quote. He also would return to the remains once they were disarticulated and spread them around, so they were eventually found in different locations, just like Kimmy Kai. It really wasn't surprising that given the lack of resources in the 1970s and 1980s, no DNA, no GPS, few surveillance cameras, and so on, that Gary Ridgway managed to elude capture for so long. But captured he was, and in 2003, he sang like a canary so he could live out his life in prison. The problem was, Gary Ridgway didn't know who Bones 16 and 17 were. He remembered Kimi Kai Pitsour and that he had killed one of them before her and one of them after her. They had died sometime in the spring or summer of 1983. He remembered exactly where he had placed the three bodies and in 2002 showed the investigators the precise spots where they'd been recovered. He told them he chose the wooded ravine because he used to drive by the cemetery on his way to work as a truck painter at the Kenilworth plant and thought it looked like an excellent place to put some of his bodies. This from the Seattle Times, quote, Tom Jensen, a retired King County Sheriff's detective who dedicated most of his career to the Green River case and still volunteers his institutional knowledge with investigators, recalled that Ridgway confessed to leaving three victims near the cemetery. He said he killed them, strangled them, and then took them down the hill and put them at the bottom of the ravine, Jensen said. Then he talked about going back and picking up one skull and taking it up to the top of the hill where he dropped it and couldn't find it in the dark. He moved things around. Just to throw you guys off, is what he would say. On November 5th, 2003, Ridgway pleaded guilty to 48 charges of aggravated murder. He would add one more, Becky Marrero, in 2011, bringing his total number of official victims to 49. He has maintained, though, that his actual number of victims is closer to 75 or 80. Two of the murders covered by the plea agreement were Bones 16 and 17. Those words, Bones 16 and Bones 17, were read out in court in the place of names. At his sentencing, Ridgway told the court, I'm sorry for killing those ladies. They had their whole lives ahead of them. No one believes him. This from the Washington Post, quote, when a psychologist asked him to rate himself on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being the worst kind of evil, Ridgway thought for a moment. I'd say a 3. 3, the psychologist asked. Uh-huh, Ridgway affirmed. For one thing is, I killed him. I didn't torture him. They went fast. Well, how considerate. In 2012, Bones 16 was identified through DNA testing as Sandra Majors. Sandra's family contacted King County authorities and said, our daughter went to Seattle in 1982 and disappeared. They requested kinship testing to be conducted to compare the unidentified victims of Gary Ridgway. That testing by the King County Medical Examiner's Office showed that Bones 16 was Sandra. Here is a letter from her family, quote, we were aware of the lifestyle Sandra lived, but she was still a part of our family. We last saw Sandra here in New York in 1982. We received a letter from her in 1982 with a Seattle postmark, but no return address. We never heard from her again and did not know what happened to her. Recently, one of Sandra's cousins saw a television show about the Green River Killer. We learned that the remains of some of the victims had not been identified. Since the last contact with Sandra had been the letter from Seattle, we decided to make contact with investigators to see if Sandra was one of the unidentified victims. We respectfully ask that the media allow us privacy. Bones 17 was not so fortunate. She remained unidentified, even though that same year, in 2012, she was entered into NCMEC and NamUs's databases. Time passed. In 2006, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children had created a reconstructed image of Bones 17 based on her skull structure, hoping that someone would recognize her. Another was done with updated technology in 2016. Isotope testing was also performed by the Smithsonian, the process of conducting chemical testing on the bones to determine what waterborne isotopes are embedded, which can indicate geographical connections. Per Global News Canada, quote, results show she was either from or had spent time in Alaska, Montana, North Dakota, Idaho, Wyoming, or several portions of southern Canada, including British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, Newfoundland, and Labrador. It didn't help. No one came forward to identify Bone 17. Three Ridgway victims now remained unidentified, Bone 17, and two sets of remains labeled Bones 10 and Bones 20. In 2021, there was a push to identify Bone 17. King County Sheriff Mitzi Johannicht told the media, quote, there is renewed urgency in this case. 35 years have passed since Bones 17's discovery, and investigators want to connect the family before memories and other evidence fade, end quote. An investigation team from the King County Sheriff's Office Major Crimes Unit began working with famed anthropologist Dr. Catherine Taylor to conduct additional testing. Using grant money, they also began working with Parabon Nanolabs. This from Parabon's press release, quote, in September 2019, KCSO reached out to Parabon for assistance. Despite only 3.04% of the entire sample registering as human DNA, due to the commingling of bacterial and/or plant DNA, Parabon was able to provide DNA phenotype information, end quote. Parabon's bioinformatics processes permitted the lab successfully to create a SNP profile of Bone 17 using genetic markers in her genome, which permitted Parabon to conduct phenotyping. The phenotype information about Bone 17 gathered from her DNA was used by NCMEC to produce a scientific composite of Bone 17 using 3D modeling software. It showed her with fair skin, an oval face, blonde hair, blue eyes that were set a little close together, full cheeks, and a thin nose. All of this took about a year. Then Parabon's C.C. Moore commenced the forensic genealogy analysis on the Bone 17 case. She uploaded the SNP profile to GenMatch and then FamilyTree DNA. And boy, was it complicated. The genealogy analysis in this case took nearly 2 years. The top DNA relative, a male, matched Jane Doe, i.e., Bone 17, at 343 centimorgans of DNA. But he was deceased, which meant that he could not be helpful in providing family tree information or a reference sample. And the more CC dug into this top DNA relative, the more hazy the picture became. And the reason for this was CC figured out that he was adopted. She had to figure out who this top DNA relative really was, not his adopted name, but his birth name, to see where he related to Bone 17. This top DNA relative was descended from a group of sisters who were very hard to track. One of them was his birth mother, but it was hard to figure out which one. They had all married a bunch of times, with lots of name changes and geographic relocations and children that Cece had to try to pin down. There were also misattributed parentage events throughout the family at different generational levels, meaning that family members who were full kinship relations on paper were actually half-kinship relations. The purported father of these sisters, who was actually not the father of some of them, also used an alias, moved across the country, and started a whole new life under this new name. All of this gives me a massive headache, and Cece told me that even she was spinning her wheels. Cece did have a genetic network including the name Du Bois, which turned out to be Bone 17's maternal grandmother's name, but she didn't know this at the time. She had one line with French-Canadian roots that she could not find a connection to, and another from Poland. On Bone 17's paternal line, she could only find fourth great-grandparents. All of this required mapping out 2 to 3 dozen second through eighth cousins of Bone 17 and going back to the 1600s. She told me she was eventually able to triangulate at Bone 17's second great-grandparents through their marriage, and their granddaughter proved to be Bone 17's grandmother. The top DNA relative was likely a half-first cousin once removed to Bone 17, who on paper was a full cousin. So finally, Cece was able to isolate the family tree branch she believed Bone 17 must fall into. She knew she was looking for a teenager, which complicates things in these old cases because the young person usually left few public footprints behind. They aren't old enough to vote, they don't own property, they don't pay taxes, they might not even have a driver's license. And of course, in the 1980s, there was no digital footprint either. This victim did not have a Facebook page, and according to the publicly available historical documents Cece could access, no one in the family she was looking at fit the bill. Then, searching old newspaper databases, she found an obituary. In the January 19, 1972 edition of the Seattle Times was reference to the passing of William S. Respotnik. Cece had searched this surname, knowing from the DNA relatives in the databases that Bone 17 was somehow connected to this family, but she had no other matches to the line containing the Respotnik name, so it was a shot in the dark. William Respotnik's obit said he was of Juneau, Alaska, formerly of Seattle, husband of Donna, father of William George, and Lori Ann. Who was Lori Ann? Cece had previously come across William George, who had lived to adulthood, before digging up this obituary. She knew that he was in Bone 17's tree. And now, for the first time, it looked like William George might have a sister. She set her sights on Lori Ann Rasputnik. Cece told me that Alaska does not have a public birth index, which is why she couldn't find Lori much earlier. She couldn't see that there was a daughter in this family tree who was the right age to be Bone 17. And there was no mention of Lori in any other family obituaries she had located. This is all from Alaska Public Radio, which did a terrific piece on this case. Donna Hurley was unloading groceries in front of her Juneau, Alaska home one day in September when two men approached. They said they were detectives with the King County Sheriff's Office, and she invited them inside. They told Hurley they believed they had identified Lori. I said, "Oh no," and then I just went into shock. "There's no other way to say it," she said. "I went through all the motions like a robot," end quote. The detectives requested a DNA sample from Donna. In a daze, she gave one. The sample was sent to the University of North Texas, which tested the sample against the DNA obtained from Bone 17. The testing confirmed a parent-child relationship. Bones 17 was Lori Ann Rasputnik. Lori Ann Rasputnik was born on November 13, 1967, in Juneau, Alaska, to young parents Donna Marks and William S. Rasputnik, Jr. She had an older brother, William George, born in 1965. The family lived in Alaska but moved to Lewis County, Washington, when Lori was a child. Donna has described Lori as a whip-smart kid who could get A's in school without trying and who was a real firecracker. She was adventurous, daring, not afraid of anything. She played baseball. She rode horses and snowmobiles. She ran track and wanted to ride motorcycles. She trained the family dog named Flip to perform in a dog show. She took on anyone bullying her older brother. She was what we used to call headstrong. But Lori was deeply affected by her father's death from Hodgkin's disease in 1972 when he was just 24 years old. Lori was only 5. She was a daddy's girl and his loss was devastating. Perhaps that partially explained her brashness and need for adrenaline. Donna said that when she reached her teen years, Lori started to butt heads with her and became a discipline problem for the single mother. Lori started to get in trouble in the 7th grade, skipping school, shoplifting from local stores, and even running away several times. Her mother told KUOW, quote, "Lori was in that rough and awkward teenage stage. It was just a tough period for her." Donna recalled the incident that resulted in Lori leaving the house that last time, in 1982, when she was just 14. Lori wanted a horse, badly. She begged, pleaded, whined, negotiated. She would pay to rent stall space and feed and water the steed. Donna said no. Horses are expensive, and she was a single mom struggling to raise 2 kids on her own. It was a non-starter. And Donna felt she had no choice but to embrace tough love with her rebellious teen daughter. Lori was infuriated and left. This time, she didn't come back. But she did call once. Donna believes it was Thanksgiving 1982, when Lori phoned her grandparents' house, where she knew the family would be, and said she was living in Seattle. She was happy. Her mom had no idea how her daughter was supporting herself or how she planned to pay for the Christmas presents she said she planned to send home. No presents arrived. They never heard from Lori again. Donna tried to find Lori by hiring a PI, but he couldn't locate Lori. And the year Lori left was when the Green River Killer began his murderous campaign against women in King County, where Seattle is, where Lori said she had gone. Donna told the New York Times that as stories about the Green River killings hit the news over and over again, she wondered in the back of her mind whether her daughter could have met that fate. But she dismissed those fears, certain that someone would have told her, someone would have come knocking. No one did. Donna said, quote, "It was easier to go on with life thinking that she was alive and well and raising a family and, you know, just being herself." She admitted later that she was in denial. She says she saw photos of the Jane Doe Green River Killer victims when they were released, but never thought that any of them looked like Lori. And when the police showed up and told her they believed they'd identified Lori, she still didn't recognize the phenotype-based composite image they showed her. It wasn't Lori. Her daughter had curly hair. Her daughter had an impish grin. But it was Lori. Now 76 years old, Donna finally had her daughter back. She admitted to Alaska Public Radio that it was a relief to finally have answers. Quote, "I guess everyone calls it closure, but to me, it was just a relief. All of the what-ifs, how come, Where has she been? All the questions that go through your mind. You quit trying to fool yourself that she's alive and well, raising a family and everything is good. It's just a relief that all of that is off your shoulders and off your mind," end quote. Lori's brother William had died of cancer in 2010 at age 44, and of course, her father had died when she was a child. Donna said she intended to bury Lori at Evergreen Washelli Cemetery in Seattle, where her father was buried. Donna told KUOW, quote, "I've buried my entire family now. She will be the last one." Donna told Fox 13 Seattle that the knowledge that Lori was killed by the Green River Killer gives her a new layer of guilt that she couldn't find her daughter, could not save her from that fate. She and other family members told King 5 that while they were relieved to have closure on Lori's case, it was hard to swallow that Gary Ridgway remains alive and well in prison at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. He has been there longer than Lori was alive. One thing I would like to know the answer to, whether it was indeed Gary Ridgway who stole that Lincoln Continental and drove it down the ravine where Kimmy Kai, Lori, and Sandra Majors were. Sergeant Eric White of the King County Sheriff's Office told me the answer to that might be buried somewhere in the thousands of pages of Ridgway interview transcripts. If anyone listening knows the answer, please reach out. Personally, I feel that knowing what we know about Ridgway and the diabolical games he played, it's too much of a coincidence to not have been him. Let's talk about the two other unidentified Ridgway victims. Bones 10 had been found on March 21, 1984, by the dog of the manager of the Little League baseball field in Burien, Washington. The DNA Doe Project took on the task of identifying Bones 10. In 2020, the all-volunteer organization announced that it had successfully used genealogy to identify this Ridgway victim as Wendy Stevens, who had run away from home at age 14. I'm reading here from an article in Medium about the identification of Wendy. Quote, "In 2020, the DNA Doe Project obtained bone fragments from Jane Doe B10 and sent them to a third-party lab, Estrella Forensics, for further testing. Estrella Forensics was able to create a family tree for Jane Doe B10, and after much searching, they came across the possible parents of Jane Doe. In late 2020, Cecile Gaspar of Denver, Colorado, received a knock at the door she never thought would come. Cecile agreed to submit a DNA test. Weeks later, she finally learned the long-awaited truth. In August 1983, Cecile's daughter, 14-year-old Wendy Stevens, disappeared from their Denver, Colorado home. Wendy was a bright and intelligent young woman, but in the summer of 1983, she'd become rebellious and was hanging out with the wrong crowds. She would run away from home for a few days at a time. But August 1983 would be the last. Cecile tried to report her daughter missing, but was brushed off each time," end quote. According to the DNA Doe Project, early in 2019, one of Wendy's parents had taken a direct-to-consumer DNA test and uploaded the results to GEDmatch, hoping to learn the fate of their daughter. Unbeknownst to the parent, GEDmatch changed the setting on that kit in May 2019 as part of their new policy regarding law enforcement's access to matches. Because the parent's kit remained opted out, when the DNA Doe Project uploaded Jane Doe's data in September 2020, that important connecting lead was not immediately available to the team. Since Lori's case was resolved, the final unidentified victim of the Green River Killer has been given her name back. This was one of the two women Gary Ridgway dumped in Tigard, Oregon, who were found in 1985. One set of the remains was just a skull, and she was identified through dental records as Tammy Lyles. Separate, skull-less remains located in 2003 near Kent Des Moines Road in South King County, Washington, after Ridgway led investigators there were unidentified, and the woman became known as Bones 20. But in 2023, testing and forensic genealogy by Othram Labs on Bones 20 proved that those remains were, in fact, the rest of Tammy Lyles. She was the last of Ridgway's 49 confessed victims to be identified, finally quashing the after effects of the unimaginable havoc wreaked by Gary Ridgway. But who knows how many more are out there. Recently, I let listeners know about a new benefit available to them called an Abject Insider subscription that's available through Apple Podcasts. An Abject Insider subscription will give listeners ad-free access to every bit of DNA ID content published, both past episodes and future episodes. It will also give you benefits like early access and bonus content. head over to Apple Podcasts and click on the DNA ID show page or the Abject Entertainment channel to start a free trial. Thanks for listening to this episode of DNA ID. If you'd like to listen to the show ad-free and help support the show in the process, please head over to patreon.com/DNAID. And if you're interested in some fun DNA ID merch, visit the store at customizedgirl.com/s/DNAID podcast. To contact the show, please email us at DNAIDpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on social media at DNA ID Podcast on Instagram, at DNA ID Podcast on Twitter, or on Facebook at facebook.com/DNAIDpodcast. Finally, if you want to visit our website, go to DNAIDpodcast.com. You'll be able to get all the episodes of the show, leave comments on episodes that I can respond to, and you can even leave voicemails. You'll get all the latest news about the show and important updates. Find links to our social media, merch, and a lot more. It's really your one-stop shop for everything DNA ID. DNA ID is written, researched, and hosted by me, Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by me and Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Music by Connor Betancourt. Check out our other collaborative podcasts, Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons, and Beyond Bizarre True Crime.